Hello, I'm Hugh Rimmington. Welcome to the Roundtable. Australians are getting fatter. Whatever we think we are doing about it, plainly it isn't working. And that suggests that one thing we tend to do a lot of, which is shaming people who are overweight, well, that doesn't seem to be working either. More than two-thirds of Australian adults are overweight or worse. Over the last 20 years, obesity rates have risen by roughly 50%. So given this is an issue that's going to affect most of us, if it hasn't already, let's talk about it. This is a no-fat shaming session. We want to know why we're getting bigger, what are the dangers, are there ways to reverse it, and can we find ways to talk about all this in a more helpful way? Joining us at the round table are Professor John Dixon, who came to obesity research 20 years ago after working in rural primary care. He is the head of clinical obesity research at the Baker IDI Heart and Diabetes Institute. Professor Stephen Simpson is executive director of Obesity Australia. He's professor at the School of Life and Environmental Sciences at the University of Sydney. And Dr. Liz Sturgis is a clinical researcher at ANU who came to obesity issues from her work as a family GP. Now, let's start off by trying to define the issue, I guess. The first question is, what is obesity? Professor Simpson.
It's simply defined and conveniently defined, if not entirely appropriately at times, by BMI, which is the body mass index, which is the relationship between your weight and your height. And formally, if you've got a BMI over 30, then you're considered to have reached an obese category. Now, it's not an entirely adequate measure because there are various ways in which BMI can be an inaccurate measure of body fatness, but it's the one that's widely used, accompanied by waist circumference as another measure.
And is it, plainly is getting worse in Australia? How much worse is it getting in Australia, Professor Dixon?
Well, there's been a trebling really since the late 70s when this epidemic took off. And we've seen this consistent process over this last 30 years. And as a result of that, around at the moment we have between 28 and 30% of Australians obese. When we started, when things were rather plateaued in the 60s and 70s, it was around 8%. So it's been a catastrophic change, as it has been globally. And we've really been able to do nothing about preventing this problem.
Why is that? That seems remarkable that a health issue of such significance is being so badly managed. John Dixon?
The problem is that many people are on the same page. Patients who have this problem believe that they're the problem. It's their lack of personal responsibility, that their problems with willpower, problems with compliance. They feel that they're weak. There's a belief out there that if we just correct some of our lifestyle processes, our diet and exercise, that all will be well. And nothing could be further from the truth. If you like, the community, our patients and our politicians are all on the same page, but it's the wrong page. It's a page that denies the determinants of obesity and the biology of obesity, and that it's very difficult to change the course of a person's weight from very early years in life. In fact, many of the determinants are there before the children get a choice to make decisions themselves about what sort of food they're going to eat or what sort of physical activity and other behavioural factors that they're going to use in a day. So we need to change the conversation. We need to legitimise the biology, legitimise our understanding of the determinants, and treat this as a disease rather than as an issue of personal responsibility and personal failing.
Dr. Liz Sturgis, you came to obesity research from your work as a family GP. What do you say to the people who come in who are overweight?
Yeah, I'm the first to put my hand on my heart and say I was exactly in that position 5 years ago. 5 years ago, I started my PhD work and I really thought we just had to get GPs having the right conversations with patients and we could fix obesity. And that's completely not the case. And for me, I'd already been in my medical career for about 10 years at that point. We have very little training for health professionals around what obesity is. And much of what health professionals bring to their patients and their understanding are those community myths that John has just talked about.
So bust the myths. When you're sitting in front of someone, we've just heard there from John that some of this stuff is being essentially established before childhood in utero. What's going on that's making us get larger faster?
Yeah, so if we look at our community as a whole, the average weight of Australians is going up. And it's interesting that we still think that that's just because of people's individual choices. If I think about an area that we've done well in, so I think the ACT, where I'm from, and was really interesting in 2013, Katie Gallagher actually took obesity out of the health sector in her cabinet and put it into the Chief Minister Department. And what she did was look at it as a system issue. So looking at it in health, in urban planning, in education. Because as a GP, even if I give people advice around better nutrition or physical activity, if they're then going back into the community where they have no option for actually putting any of that into practice, we're really fighting a losing battle, really.
Let's have a look at the dangers of obesity for a start off. If I could go to you, Professor Stephen Simpson from Obesity Australia, what are the risks, not just obesity, but of overweight, which affects about two-thirds of adult Australians?
Overweight and obesity are linked to pretty well any chronic disease condition that you can imagine. So increased rates of all manner of cancers. There are clearly physical issues around joints and musculoskeletal effects, type 2 diabetes and metabolic disorders generally, and all manner of other associated issues emerge out of obesity. And there's been discussion around, is obesity itself a disease? And it quite clearly is what we call a chronic relapsing disease process. It's driven by, as John said, powerful biological forces that are operating within our modern so-called obesogenic environment. And the social costs, the economic costs are just enormous. And the healthcare costs are just part of that because it flows over into mental health and all manner of other aspects of our daily lives and our well-being within modern society.
I mean, this is a thing which is confusing on some level, that the sheer speed of this increase. We are not, in evolutionary terms, any different to the creatures that we were in the 1950s. So is it something about the food that we eat more than anything else that is bringing this on?
Yes, you're exactly right, Hugh. We're not unlike any other living organism, for that matter. Any animal has evolved biologies that minimize unnecessary energy expenditure and maximize access to safe, palatable foods. We've had a brain which has enabled us to actually build a world in every respect that meets our heart's desires. We have a food production and supply system that's maximizing the qualities that were missing ancestrally for us. We've built our cities, our homes, our workplaces to allow us to expend minimal energy. We've got economic systems that value wealth over health. We want to buy the things that aren't necessarily particularly good for us when it comes to food. Essentially, we've built a world which is just making it increasingly difficult to maintain a healthy weight. And obesity is quite simply a normal biological response to the world that we've built.
Well, one other thing, Professor John Dixon, that you mentioned, is that it starts very early. Even in utero, I've read about epigenetics having a role in this. Can you explain any of that?
Yes, Hugh. Our genes that we've had for many, many thousands of years have not changed in recent times. There are genetic associations with obesity that are very strong. Our genes that we've inherited over the years do have a large propensity to determine whether we can become obese or not. But this epidemic has really come along at a time where we have had these metabolic programmings. We're actually not designed to come into a world of plenty that Steve has just explained. We are designed to come into quite a different world. And in fact, Caucasians are probably better at dealing with the land of plenty than our indigenous communities and many of our other communities.
Why do you say that?
because perhaps the Europeans have had the land of sufficiency and plenty for longer than others, if we look at the epidemic in Asia, the epidemic in our indigenous communities and any indigenous communities around the world, in Africa and also in South America, we see catastrophic increases in not only obesity, but the complications of obesity. Perhaps it's best seen in our indigenous community, where we see this change from a hunter-gatherer existence, a very healthy profile of a population, to the presence of metabolic disease, hypertension, heart disease, kidney disease, diabetes, etc., and that central obesity that we see in our indigenous community. So what we're seeing there is a very rapid change from a lean hunter-gatherer land to a land of plenty being put next to a supermarket, etc. So it's that environmental change that is most dramatic in those populations where it's become very rapidly changing. So when we look at these determinants, we've got to think about what's programmed in utero, and even what's programmed as the developing germ cell develops. So how we need to focus enormously in our systems thinking on early life, that time prior to pregnancy, what's happening and nutrition, etc., through pregnancy, and in those early months and years of life, particularly up until the age of about 4 or 5, we're really interested in that first 1,000 days before after conception. And what's happening there is there's maternal nutrition has a very large part to play. Habits of the parents, smoking and so forth, have a large part to play. And then at birth, we've got that the introduction of we've got breastfeeding, we've got introduction of foods, we've got changes that also occur early in life with the gut microbiome, with the implanting of or the delivery of the microbiome to the child's gut from the parents and so forth. So there's so many things, not just epigenetic changes, which are ways we change our expression of genes, but there are programming, metabolic programming changes and changes to our gut microbiome, and all this is happening in that first 1,000 days of life.
You're listening to The Roundtable on RN. We're discussing the obesity epidemic. Let's talk about how we get it off. Because one of the things, the old saying goes, a moment on the lips, a lifetime on the hips. There is some scientific truth in that, isn't there, Liz Sturgis?
There is, Hugh. And as people put on weight and they have more weight on for a peak period of time, the body can accept that new weight as the new normal. And when you start to lose a bit of weight, the body does everything it can to try and put the weight back on. Things like reducing your metabolic rate, so you sort of burn up calories more slowly. And it also changes your hormone profile, so you actually feel more hungry and you feel less satisfied with food. And there has been shown, for instance, in a reality TV program where they get people to lose weight really quickly and rapidly. They looked at contestants 6 years after that program. All of them had put their weight back on, but their body was still in that starvation mode, still their metabolic rate through their boots and their hormones trying to keep weight back on them. So really those contestants had quite a lot of harm done to them.
So the trick to losing weight, the only real effective trick to losing weight, is not to put it on.
Prevention is really important, and I think that's where GPs have a really important role, because we see people actually from when you're in utero, we look after you in your mum's tummy all the way through life. And we know there are particular times in your life you're more likely to put on weight, like having new kids and a new family routine around the place. Really important to start having those conversations. But as a medical community, we are up against sort of the commercial providers that say you can get your summer body back quickly, don't worry about it, just do a bit of exercise, a bit of fad dieting, and it'll all come off. And we know that's really not true.
So what is the language that now, do you think, should be used? Stephen Simpson from Obesity Australia, the language that we have been using plainly hasn't been working. Some say it's the shaming language. What do we have to do to get the right message across?
I think we do. You're exactly right here. We need to move away from the frame of putting everything back onto personal responsibility. And it's not about abdicating personal responsibility, because As Liz was saying, if you can keep the weight off prior to entering that slippery slope towards increasing BMI and then making it harder and harder and harder to get back out again, then you have some volition to do that. And we need to not advocate personal responsibility, but rather to support and empower individuals, their families, their communities, to actually live healthier lives, and to offer effective pathways to treatment and care where people have got to the point where they need it. And that requires a whole of society response. It's too easy to blame individuals. That clearly hasn't worked. The idea that somehow people are slothful and gluttonous, that now applies to the majority of us. It hasn't worked. It's a massive failure in public health policy, if you like. And we just need to have a more sophisticated system-wide view. And that requires a sort of an integrated strategy that engages more than government. It's not government's fault. It's not individuals' fault. It's a problem for us all to solve together. And happily, that's starting to happen. So we're seeing signs of coalitions forming across the sort of professional organisations. We've just, for example, launched the Obesity Collective recently, which is a very large cross-sectoral group of academics and not-for-profits and corporates and government and campaigners and others who are starting to really think seriously about the system-wide approach to obesity. We need to address the environment. We need to address the behaviour of individuals. We need to support communities, workplaces, schools and education institutions and so on.
There is a debate in Australia about whether the images that appear in our media, which tend to be of more slender people, and certainly the positive imaging is around slenderness, leanness, that perhaps that needs to change into more realistic images everywhere so that we look at people who look back at and look more like us. There is a counter-argument, I suppose, which says that that normalises overweight. Do you have a view on that, Professor John Dixon?
Yes, I think what we've seen is that the normalisation of overweight and at least class one obesity as to being normal in our community. And that's reasonable because indeed most people are overweight or obese. There's not a lot in the numbers in the class one, in the normal weight range, are the minority of the community. But I think we've got to be realistic. We should be depicting people as they are, and not really have a belief that depicting that anorexia and other low weight issues are directly driven by the obesity disease and our blame regarding this. I think they're two quite different issues. I think when we look at our community today and you look at the mental health and the anguish of people who suffer from obesity, the depression, the binge eating, the feeling out of control, hating themselves, these sort of things need to be addressed, and they need to be addressed in the same way we address other complications of obesity. Respect, dignity, explaining that this is a process that they weren't in control of, and being able to deal with not only their physical issues but their mental issues as well. And I think that's a very important area, and that's probably an area why we shouldn't be. Focusing on very, very lean, being very, very perfect. That's not the world we live in, and it's not a reality. And I think the fashion industry is actually coming to grips with that.
Is the issue here, Liz Sturgis, not so much weight but health?
I think that's a really good point, Hugh. So although BMI is a marker of obesity, it's not the only marker that determines people's health outcomes. So if you look at, say, smoking risk, smoking actually affects your health far more than being overweight. So if people are worried about putting on weight when they give up smoking, we don't want to then make people not give up smoking, for say. I think shifting our goals into health goals is something we can do for everyone, because even people who are living in slim bodies Sometimes they are very sedentary. We know that not doing any exercise is really bad for your heart health, regardless of what your body weight is.
So do you think you would be recommending to GPs that to say to someone, look, do some exercise, get out there and do some exercise. It probably realistically isn't going to drop you down to a size 8.
Yep.
But it will be good for you. So
absolutely. So one thing I've learned is don't cheer the scales. Don't when someone jumps on the weighing machine, don't go, oh, fantastic, look at that number. You can't control what number comes up on the scales. We should be talking about how many times did you walk this week? How did you make that work with the very stressful life you lead? How did you go improving your nutrition? Talking about behaviours and things we can do that the person has control over. And again, thinking like the other speakers have said, the systems that we can then put in place to support those individual behaviours.
And do you think GPs need to be informed better than they have been?
Yeah, well, I mean, until I started this, I had more than 10 years of medical training, and I remember reading the chapter in the NHNMRC obesity guidelines that talks about the biology that John went over really beautifully, and being shocked to my core and absolutely surprised that this is truthfully what is going on in this condition, because most medical professionals are not taught about it. We don't have it as a subject much in medical school or through many of the specialty training programs.
Stephen Simpson from Obesity Australia, there's anecdotal evidence that people who feel overweight and obese are in fact less likely, not more likely, to go to the doctor, because that sense of being shamed by the doctor about, you know, their lack of discipline or willpower or whatever, and so they just stop going to the doctor at the very time they really do need, you know, good long-term connections with their GPs.
No, that's true. It's actually more than that. You'll find people start to move away from social interactions as they become heavier and more concerned and worried about themselves, disappointed in themselves. It's this, again, this personal responsibility issue. And they become then socially isolated, and then that leads to comfort eating, and that makes it worse. And so it becomes a vicious feedback and cycle that really makes things worse and worse. So it's really hard to overstate the danger and the damage that's done by this view that it's somehow your fault. And it's liberating. I think two things are liberating. One is to understand that there's some really powerful biology involved. We've spoken about that. And the other is that, as Liz just said, it's about health, not cosmetic appearance. Weight is a health issue, and just moderate decreases in weight, or not even that, increases in exercise, improvement in the quality of the food that you eat, will have benefits to your health, which are really distinct from cosmetic effects. And we really have to get that across. And the fact that this is a lifestyle change, this isn't a quick fix. It's not a matter of rapidly losing weight and somehow you've solved the problem. You haven't. You've, in many ways, exacerbated it. It's really about changing your lifestyle, your behaviours, in ways that support not only your own health, but that of your unborn children, your families, your communities, and everybody, ultimately.
John Dixon, is surgery going to be a normal part of the life of an Australian?
Well, I think treatment for obesity, effective treatment beyond lifestyle. I think we've just heard from Steve and Liz that we can have a perfect diet and we can have perfect exercise, and that makes us much healthier. But it doesn't necessarily change the scales. And we're not surprised by this, because we have effective treatments for diabetes, hypertension, lipid problems, cancer, that go beyond lifestyle. So whether we like it or not, this serious disease needs treatment for those that are really affected by it, that's beyond lifestyle. And that's going to mean things such as specific diets, pharmacological treatments, and surgery. To date, surgery is the best therapy we have, and it's most effective because it changes the brain. It changes that relationship between the size of the meal and how much and how you feel. People can have can eat half the amount of food over many, many years and be completely satisfied. It changes the regulation of weight in the brain. If you like, it's a bit like your blood pressure. If you've got high blood pressure, you have effective treatment bringing the blood pressure down. But we then regulate around a different weight. Obesity surgery does that. Of all the types we have, it does that, and it does it over many, many years, over 20 years, as shown by the elegant Swedish obese subject study. So surgery is there. It does work. A problem with surgery and drugs and specific diets is that no one really gets them. In Australia today, there are about 22,000 bariatric procedures, weight loss procedures done every year. Over 20,000 of them are in our private hospitals, very few in our public hospitals. We have none of the increasing numbers of effective drugs available on our PBS pharmaceutical benefits, and we have and they're relatively expensive for people to tackle. When we look at these beyond lifestyle treatments, less than 5% of our community, or less than 5% of those who have an indication for them, actually get surgery or effective dietary processes or surgery. So, in fact, most people with obesity, most people and people with very severe obesity in our community have no effective treatment beyond lifestyle for their weight and get so frustrated with that. So we've got to rethink our therapy to saying beyond lifestyle, we're doctors, we're health professionals, beyond lifestyle treatments should be used in those that need them, and they should be scaled up as the disease worsens or as the problem enhances and as people aren't adequately responding to the next level of treatment down, just as we would for diabetes, high blood pressure, cancer, etc.
We're getting a lot of responses through on our text line. Someone suggesting I use a smaller plate for my food. Someone else saying there is no diet better than Photoshop. But this from Giselle, who says, why do we avoid speaking of the fructose-laden carbonated soft drinks that fill an entire aisle in the two big supermarkets? We don't have much time, but would you support, Professor Simpson, a sugar tax?
Well, I think the evidence that putting a levy on sugar-sweetened beverages would influence the intake of sugar in amongst society is pretty overwhelming. That is, it seems, politically unpalatable, and it's hopeful that if you look at, for example, sales of sugar-sweetened beverages, they're tanking. Sugar commodity prices also falling. So I suspect even if things are politically difficult to do, then the growing awareness amongst the general public is going to fix that problem ultimately. But yes, it's clearly sugar-sweetened beverages are extraneous to requirements when it comes to calories. The calories that are consumed in that form are doing no good whatsoever unless you happen to be starving.
Sadly, that's all we have time for. I hope that has been useful to you. You've just heard from Professor Stephen Simpson, the Executive Director of Obesity Australia. Also at the roundtable, Professor John Dixon, the Head of Clinical Obesity Research at the Baker IDI Heart and Diabetes Institute, and Dr. Liz Sturgis, a GP and clinical researcher at ANU. Thanks for listening. I'm Hugh Remington. Until next week.